Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. So, do you want marketing made simple? Shopify removes the guesswork with built-in tools that help you create, execute, and analyze all your online marketing campaigns. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/income. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everybody out there. Welcome to another episode of Broadway Breakdown. I am Matt Koplik. With me today is an alum of the pod, my roommate, my soul sister, my drag inspiration, my mother, Dani Ticton Koplik. Hello, Dani.
Hello, son. How are you?
I'm so well. Today's been a very stressful day while we got this recording ready to go. You were working on a paper, and I was working on another project, and then I had to get dinner started because I'm the one who keeps this household together.
Yeah, of course.
No, you had a whole string where you were making dinner, and then I think I've just been responsible the last three, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not including the one we ordered.
Well, and then I paid for that.
Well,
so
you didn't have to.
I know I didn't have to, but still, it happened.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to have that erasure in this household. I won't allow it.
I'm grateful.
Wonderful. So it's been a minute, and we also have some screaming toddlers in the room next door, so hopefully no one can hear them on the podcast, but
not
we'll see.
My toddlers, neighbors' toddlers.
Yes,
just
I said in the room next door. Yes. It's through the wall.
The apartment next door.
Whatever. I don't care. I don't care
anymore. I just want to clarify that I don't have toddlers. Okay?
No, you don't have toddlers, but we are talking about toddlers today. We are talking about an all-American classic that's both good and bad in a lot of ways. It's sort of a mystery, and we're going to kind of get into it today, and it's had many iterations, and I think people both remember it inaccurately and accurately. I don't know, nostalgia is a weird thing. What are we talking about today, Mother?
We're talking about the movie versions of Annie.
Yes, Annie the musical. We're going to talk a little bit about the stage show as well, because it's going to give us some context for the movie versions. Primarily, we're going to be talking about the 1982 original movie, the 1999 adapted for TV movie. We're not going to talk so much about the 2014 remake. I have seen it. I did some reviewing of it this morning at work to sort of give myself some context. It's just so much a departure from the stage show that to the point that it's not even an adaptation. So we're mostly going to be talking about the other two since they're closer. But, you know, we'll see where we get into. So what is Annie? In a nutshell, what is Annie?
It is a show that was inspired by a comic strip that was running, I guess, during the Depression. And then
ran
after
for a long time, yeah. Started in 1924. Oh, wait, sorry, I have dates here. Hold on. I did research. Created by Harold Gray. It debuted in 1924, and it lasted up until 2010, in that period, there were some times when they were just sort of reprinting old strips, and then they would have a spell where they would do new ones. They had a whole bunch of different people at the helm because the creator, Harold Gray, died in 1968. So...
Wow.
Yeah. So in those 42 years, I guess, since he died, there were a couple of different guys who took over. But yes, the musical
just
of that. Yes.
Whose intellectual property would that be then? The newer
strips? Well, I guess it would be Harold Gray's because it's...
The new strips too?
Well, it probably falls under the idea that he created.
Maybe licensed or something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure whoever continued with the strips signed a contract, you know, maybe getting royalties from what they... create it, but they don't get shares of the actual Little Orphan Annie. What's the word I'm looking for?
Proceeds?
Yeah, legacy, empire. Yeah,
right.
You know, foundation.
But we digress.
Yeah, we digress. Fun fact, originally it was going to be a boy. It was going to be Little Orphan Otto. Because that just rolls off the tongue. Apparently they changed it because there was a poem in the 1800s called Little Orphan Annie, and they decided they wanted to like make a reference to that. So,
also,
you know,
in the time of the Depression, Otto isn't your basic all-American name.
Well, to be fair, it debuted before the Depression. It debuted
okay.
in the
right,
in 24. The yeah, 1924. But you know, during the Depression, I'm sure it was a great comfort to many a child in America. Annie and the Depression is primarily from the stage show. That is where it is hooked. But yes, so the stage show is based off of that. Do you remember the names of everyone who wrote the stage show? I know you remember one.
Martin Charnin.
Yes. He had the idea, he wrote the lyrics, and he directed the original production and subsequent tours. Charles Strauss did the music, and Thomas Meehan did the book.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Of course it was. Yes. You have this at your fingertips. Why am I even here? We have a little fun fact ourselves in regards to the stage show of Annie, do we not?
I guess we do.
Yeah.
If you're referring to the fact that I saw this stage show probably right when it opened. Was it the fall of 77?
April of 77.
April of 77.
So you were about to graduate.
Yeah. Yeah. I must have been on break because I took a friend with me, I recall. Yeah, so I saw that. But, there, you know, I was predisposed to liking it then because my father worked with Martin Charnin, and they had a lifelong friendship after that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were sort of a rooting section. I don't think I had the critical eye back then.
You were not allowed to not like it.
Right.
Yes. My grandfather, your father, Richard Ticton, was a theatrical lawyer, entertainment lawyer, I guess, because he didn't just deal with theater.
Right.
And Martin Charnin was a client/friend. I met Martin, actually, at Yom Kippur that Papasan and Fran hosted. So we talked for a little bit. That was nice. Yeah. You didn't see when it came out in the 90s, right? When it was brought back to Broadway?
No.
He directed that version as well. Papasan took Laura and me, my sister Laura, took us to see that version. I don't know if you remember. Nell Carter was Miss Hannigan.
Yeah.
And we got to go backstage. I think that was the first time second time I ever went backstage at a show. First time was Beauty and the Beast. And I remember getting a couple of signatures, and that was really cool. And I remember there was a big hoopla about that production because they replaced the Annie out of town. But that's sort of something that's always happened with Annie. Annie has always kind of had a lot of replacements going on behind the scenes.
It's interchangeable. It's not like you have a marquee name for someone who's 11 years old.
No, but it is a really tricky role to get right. I had an episode recently about the musical Ruthless, which I know you've heard me talk about because I've blasted the bootleg all over this apartment, but I had Morgan Reynolds on to talk about it, and we talked about how it's a really tricky role for a child actor because you need someone who's smart enough to get the humor but isn't so, I don't want to use the word precocious, but yeah, like polished enough that it feels false. And I feel like a lot of child actors, they know how to be polished, they don't know how to be intuitive and natural. Yeah. And Annie's such a heavy role, and just in terms of the fact that she's on stage so much, she carries a lot of weight, and you know, you have the wrong kind of kid actor for the part and the whole thing goes off balance.
I just have a fun fact that occurred to me, and since I'm dealing with insight right now, I just want to bring it up. A friend had gotten her new dog, a puppy, a chew toy, and the chew toy was Lamb Chop. Not a Lamb Chop, but the Lamb Chop. And I was reminded how Lamb Chop on Broadway was your first musical.
Yes, indeed it was. Wait, It might not have been. It might have been my second, because Lamb Chop, we'll look into this in some other day, because Lamb Chop was for a very short Broadway run in 94, and it's just a matter of whether it was before or after Beauty and the Beast opened, because we saw Beauty and the Beast pretty soon after it opened, I do recall.
Yeah, I think it was Lamb Chop, because I think it had that sort of, it was a milestone, you know, one of those places where it's a marker.
Yeah. I have vague memories of Lamb Chop. I mostly remember the ladies' room because you took me with me during intermission.
You were little.
Yeah, I just remember being very crowded, and I was like, how does anyone go to the bathroom in here? And it's still that way. When you think of Annie, mm-hmm. what immediately comes to mind? Like, what pops into your head?
It's sort of, despite all the red in it, kind of...
Communism, you think of communism.
No, you know, there's a certain to it, you know, there mm-hmm. isn't anything that kind of grabs you. In each version, there is something to like. Mm-hmm. You pick out, you can respect the talent, you can respect the choreography and the set design and all of that, but as a whole, you know, it's a very dated story.
Sure. Keep in mind, so you're talking about the two movies that we recently watched. Yeah, so when I told you we were going to be watching these movies to talk about, I'm assuming your immediate thought was, ugh.
No.
No?
No, I'm good with research.
You're so silly. That's, yeah, I don't, Papasan also took me to see the last revival of Annie that was on Broadway when it opened at the Palace, which Martin did not direct. We went to opening night of that, which was a lot of fun. And I will say that was sort of where I had the turning point with Annie, because for years, when I was a kid, I loved it. And I specifically loved the 99 TV movie. I had the cast album, or soundtrack, I should say, for it and everything. And then, you know, I got into my Sondheim years as a teenager, and I got a little more esoteric and snobby, and then I went to college where, you know, I had a professor who was super esoteric and snobby and really made us judgmental of a lot of different
Can we not say writers. Discriminating? You know, you learned, you developed, you know,
well,
guardrails taste parameters.
These things, you kind of go in a, it swings like a pendulum, I should say. You start off one way wholeheartedly, and then you kind of shift gears the other way wholeheartedly. And then eventually, over time, you find a happy middle. I, as a teenager in high school, definitely got off a bit on liking the things that not everyone always liked. I said on this pod earlier, for a long time with the Tony Awards, I always would root for the show that, like, probably wasn't going to win, but, like, maybe had a shot. So the year of the Producers, I was whole hog on Full Monty. The year of Spring Awakening, I was Team Grey Gardens. Last Tony Awards, everyone was about the Ferryman. I was, like, what the Constitution means to me. Things like that. So I would say, after college, I definitely kind of owned the things I liked because I would think about it a lot and sort of decide for myself if I like it because I actually think it's good or if I like it despite the fact that it may not be the best. And when I saw the Annie revival, I was kind of thrown because I was watching a production that I did not necessarily think was good of a musical that I kind of realized was. The last time I had that reaction was the Guys and Dolls revival in 2009 with Lauren Graham, which I went with your mother because I got her hooked on Gilmore Girls. And she was like, we need to go see our girl. We need to go see Lauren Graham. So we saw it, and the revival was trash. It was a bad, bad production. I felt so bad for Lauren Graham. But I sat there and I went, I'm listening to the text being spoken right now, and I understand that this musical is extremely well written. It's just being given a bad production. And same thing with this last Annie. So I kind of had a turning point with it, and I think the stage show is actually very well structured. It's very intelligent in a lot of ways because the comic strip of Annie, from what I understand, because I was not alive in 1977, I'm famously very young, but my mom just grimaced. But I mean, you probably didn't have much knowledge of the comic strip by that point. It was passé by the time you were a kid, right? Wasn't really,
you know, it was kind of milquetoast. I mean, you looked for a little bit more edge, like Doonesbury was more. Peanuts was good for just
Yeah, well, Peanuts is classic, and right. and Peanuts actually is a really good example of something that ages well, because the whole gist is that it's these children who kind of talk like adults, and that never gets old. Whereas Annie, the comic strip of Annie, like, she's very, very golly gee whiz. She talks in a very gung-ho, all-American 1930s kind of attitude, and the whole theme of the comic strip is very staunchly pro-American. Harold Gray was a conservative Republican, and so when FDR became president, he, like, kind of turned the Annie comic strip into an anti-FDR, anti-New Deal strip, and was all about how capitalism's amazing, and that, you know, the only thing distancing the poor and the rich are, you know, hard work. And, like, you work hard enough, you can get rich, and things will be okay for you, because that's the American dream. And as we know, that's kind of bullshit. And what's interesting is that the stage musical kind of does away with that in a lot of ways. It's still a very optimistic show, but they include FDR in a very positive portrayal. Annie meets him at the White House with his cabinet and kind of inspires him to come up with a New Deal. And the musical is very pro-New Deal, unlike the comic strip. And they make lighthearted jokes about Oliver Daddy Warbucks being a Republican, but it's not like, you know, evil not, Republican.
Not by current measures, right?
No, exactly. By current measures, he's a liberal. He's a progressive. Dove, right? Exactly. He makes jokes about, oh, what do Democrats eat? I'm having a Democrat over for dinner. Things like that. So yeah, it's when the musical came out, I was doing research on the concept and the sort of journey of the stage musical, because they had sort of a famous rough road to Broadway as well. They were at the Goodspeed Opera House out of town, and that was very rough because most of the reviews were kind of bad, and they replaced the main Annie with Andrea McArdle a week into the run, and they had a different actress for Miss Hannigan, and like half the songs were different. And Mike Nichols famously saw it. He liked it, so he invested money, and he was like, I'm not gonna direct it, but I will give you some notes every now and then. We're gonna go to DC with a bigger budget, and I'm gonna throw this actress at you for Miss Hannigan. Her name's Dorothy Loudon, and the rest is history with her. And they go to DC, it's a big hit. They do a couple more changes, they come to Broadway, it's an even bigger hit. And I think it was Charles Strauss or Thomas Meehan said something shifted in the 70s, because with Annie, they were just, by the, when Annie opened, Nixon had left, and the country was sort of in a swing of optimism of like, oh great, maybe politics will go back to being honest again, and the country can stop being lied to, ha 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 ha. And so New York was sort of ready for a show like Annie. They said, like, if they had opened 2 years earlier, New York probably would have rejected it, which I think is interesting. Mm-hmm. And watching clips of the stage show, what's interesting is Martin Charnin, as a director and all of his wisdom, cast very unique actors who were not really cutesy. So the show kind of knew that you thought coming in, oh, this is going to be a cutesy little family show. And then they have Dorothy Loudon drinking booze out of like a hot water bottle, slapping the orphans with a flat paddle and hamming it up. You know, the orphans are not cute. They're kind of rough because they're, you know, streetwise. And the dancing that they do is not very clean and precocious. It's all very, you know, honest. And I think that sort of helped the show gain the momentum it did, because people would come in thinking it was going to be this cutesy little polished show, and then it ends up taking them by surprise of like being very self-aware and throwing you for a loop. So when they do get to the cutesy stuff, you're like, well, it's earned now. I like this part now, you know?
Yeah, I like that way of thinking about it.
Yeah, but I think because of Annie's reputation and because of how people continue to do it, we don't really go to there anymore. Now we cast precocious kids. I was watching some clips of other productions, like when they did it at the Hollywood Bowl, and we're talking like pageant girls are playing the orphans, doing kick lines, you know, in pas de bourrées and beveling for the gods. And I'm like, this is not what they're... These are orphans in 1933. They're not beveling. Orphans don't bevel.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
Annie is sold, the film rights are sold for over $9 million back in 1978, which is like, I think
What's the present value of that?
Let me look that up. I think it's something along the lines of like $30 million, something like that. I have notes here, everybody. Equivalent of $39.2 million today. And it beat the record at the time because My Fair Lady was sold for $5.5 million to Warner Brothers, and that was the record. And then Annie went for $9.5 million. And I'm sure Hamilton has beaten that since, but that's a lot of money. But in doing so, the creatives lost all creative control of the movie. They lost any rights they had to have a say in the movie. And that led to some things. So let's get into the movie.
Sure.
When was the first time you saw this 1982 movie version of Annie? Did you see it in theaters?
Oh, I must have. I didn't see it any other way. I would have seen it that way.
I mean, I don't know if anyone told you, but you had two kids since 1982. I don't know if maybe you watched it with one of them.
Since, yes. Not in.
Okay, that was... No, I'm saying not in 1982. I'm saying I don't know if you missed the movie when it came out and then saw it with your children.
Probably.
That's probably what happened. That's what I'm thinking. I know that's definitely what happened with my father. There's no way that man saw Annie in movie theaters. Probably saw it on stage, not in movie theaters.
He'd have as much patience for that as he does for Cheesecake Factory lines.
Wow, we're just really going down memory lane. You know what also goes down memory lane? Annie. So, this movie, Mama, like, I know I had it on VHS at one point. I can see the VHS. It was like orangey gold with with Eileen Quinn, who played Annie, and Sandy on the cover. Mm-hmm. And I remember liking it as a kid, but maybe I was just impressionable. This is the first time I've watched it in maybe like 15, 20 years. It's a weird movie. It's very weird.
It is. Well, in those days, you watched everything. But this, of course, had kids in it. And so it may have felt more accessible to you.
Yeah.
At that age.
Well, so many people love this movie. They grew up with it. And I think with kids, you immediately have this chemical reaction to seeing kids in a movie do quote unquote badass things. So like when the orphans are breaking out of the orphanage and running up Fifth Avenue, when Annie's hanging from a bridge, you're like, wow, I could do that too. Or when they're tumbling and it's sort of, you know, you're seeing kids do these dangerous things or these really cool things, and you go like, that's awesome, kids can do anything. It's why Home Alone is such a, you know, big classic, because all the kids that grew up with it are, you know, thinking like, oh, I could be like Kevin McAllister, I could set up booby traps in my house and I put aftershave on my face. So I think with that, there's less distance for a lot of people on the movie, even if they've gotten older and more judgmental or have a more critical eye.
You used the word earlier, nostalgia. Probably people your age feel very nostalgic toward the movie.
Yeah, but and I think that nostalgia can cloud some of their more critical perceptions of it. So that's where I'm at. So for anyone who's living under a rock, or for some reason, I know, if you're listening to this podcast, you have to know what Annie's about. And if you don't, then, you know, bully for you. I'll do a quick brief summary. Annie's an 11-year-old orphan living in New York City in 1933 during the Great Depression. She has half of a locket and a note from her parents that says they're going to come back for her. She's had it since she was dropped off at the orphanage when she was a baby. Head of the orphanage, Miss Hannigan, drinks and terrorizes the kids. Annie escapes, comes back. Billionaire Oliver Warbucks decides, for sort of good PR, to have an orphan in his home for a week or 2 weeks, depending. And his personal secretary comes to the orphanage, picks up Annie. Annie wins over Oliver Warbucks. He wants to adopt her. She doesn't want to be adopted. She wants her real parents. So they put out a search for her parents with the $50,000 reward. Hannigan and her con artist brother Rooster and his girlfriend Lily St. Regis decide to play Annie's parents. They use Hannigan's files on her for information and to get the locket to match. It almost works, but eventually the jig is up. They are arrested. Annie gets adopted by Warbucks. FDR shows up to say there's going to be a new deal and get America out of the Great Depression. And there are some dancing orphans and a dog named Sandy.
And it was the orphans who saved her.
Well, and it's Sandy. The orphans who save her in the movie.
Oh.
Not in the show.
Oh.
So what I did was sort of a very basic plot line that kind of covers both the stage show and sort of both movie versions, because both movie versions take liberties with the show. The 99 TV movie is definitely the most respectful and most what's the word I'm looking for?
True.
Yeah, true to the stage show. It's not the exact what I was looking for, but it's the one that's most true. The 82 movie version takes a lot of liberties, including some horny and racist liberties, I should say. Yeah, so first fun fact about this movie is that it's directed by John Huston, who, if you don't know, is an Oscar-winning director of such classic films as The African Queen, because Lord knows when you're thinking, let's get a big movie musical of Annie, let's get the guy who directed Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn in The African Jungle. Let's get Angelica Houston's father. Let's get the creepy patriarch in Chinatown who, you know, is Faye Dunaway's father and fathers her child and has her, gives her the classic line, she's my daughter and my sister. Sister and my daughter. Sister, daughter, sister, daughter. Yeah, this movie, guys, I'm kind of at a loss. If you like it, please write in. Tell me what you have to say. I want to know why you like it. It's like both really elaborate and also kind of grungy looking at the same time. Maybe they were trying to go for the feel of the Great Depression, but I don't know. It more just sort of looks like stoic. It's shot really weirdly as well. Weird angles and a lot of dead space in the frame when people are dancing. It's odd. And a weird sexual energy coming from everyone. Everyone is kind of humping the camera. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, not maybe the kids, I hope, but you know. No, yeah.
Do you not recall, in the classic number, You're Never Fully Dressed Without a Smile, the orphans are dancing in the orphanage, and there's that one girl who's bouncing her hips around, yes, throwing her pelvis at, yes, the screen.
Yes.
And a lot of, like, bare-legged kids, like, running around in their underwear, and I'm not saying, like, that's sexual necessarily, but they do so in a manner that, like, it's John Huston's trying to say, like, these kids are not so innocent, and that is definitely a theme that Martin Charnin did with the stage show, but it was more like, these kids are streetwise, and John Huston's like, these kids have urges. You never fully dressed without a smile. Who cares what they're wearing on Main Street or Savile Row? What you wear from ear to ear to ear, and not from head to toe. It was odd. And then there was that one six-year-old who I'm convinced in Hard Knock Life had coke on her face. Listen, go on YouTube. It's The Hard Knock Life, 1982 Annie. There's a girl who's, like, standing on the stairwell sleeping. She's sleeping standing up. And there's a white substance on her nose and her upper lip. And maybe it's just supposed to be chalk or dust or something. It looks like coke nose. Granted, clearly it's not supposed to be coke nose because she's sleeping. And coke does the opposite of that.
Here's my response.
What?
Got milk?
What?
It couldn't have been a milk mustache?
Those aren't real.
They are. I've seen them.
You've seen milk mustaches?
Yeah.
I've only seen them in the ads, and those are clearly makeup. It's okay. Like silly putty they put on top of them, okay, lips. Okay. That's, no.
I was just being cheeky.
You? Cheeky? Never. Yeah. I will say one thing for this movie that's a big positive. It's got a stellar cast. It's got really good people. Whether they're all good in it is another question. Carol Burnett's definitely, I think she has the right idea for the role. She definitely plays up the drunkenness of it, although it's more sort of like she's constantly got a hangover. And she does a lot of bits in the song Little Girls where she sings about how much she hates her life. First of all, she's drinking water out of a flower vase. Do you remember that?
Disgusting.
Yeah. Is the implication that there's gin in there? Or...
Yeah, because she, the bathtub, it's bathtub gin.
Yeah. But when we talk about bathtub gin, I thought it meant like you brew gin in the bathtub, yeah, not like, fun, not that you just pour gin into your bathtub
water.
Well,
maybe she's getting the water out of there. I don't know. Or maybe she was too drunk to know. It was murky though, wasn't it? That water was murky.
Maybe. It could have been just that she was going absolutely insane and breaking down. So she was like, I'll turn the water on in my bathtub and pour gin in it and I'll drink the water from there. It's like, okay. Meanwhile, she's like very undressed. And also very horny. She's making out with her radio because it's a soap opera. And yeah, but she does all these little bits. Remember, she goes, with all the nuts and the squirrels, hee 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 hee. And she doesn't even end on a big note. She's like, little. And she's got a weird sexual energy with Tim Curry, who plays her brother Rooster. It's like very incestuous. Fun fact, that part was originally offered to Steve Martin.
Really?
He turned it down because Bernadette Peters was cast as Lily St. Regis by then, and they were in the middle of breaking up, and he thought that would be very painful. To which I say, tough it out, Steve Martin. You would have been so good. I mean, Tim Curry's very good as well, and he has that sort of sinister edge to him, so he's both fun to watch and dangerous. But it definitely makes, like, the energy between him and Carol Burnett odd.
They could have given him a better speech coach, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, because... Do you mean to imply that Tim Curry's Brooklyn accent is not realistic?
It's more Brit than Brooke.
More Brit than Brooke. You know, Mom, the same could be said of Albert Finney as Daddy Warbucks.
Indeed.
Although they...
It came across just as patrician with him. You know, FDR speaks sort of...
Why do I smell wet dog? Hi, there's something about a smile. Hang in the bathroom. She's not a boy. Orphans are boys. I want a boy. Leaping lizards.
Maybe he wasn't right for the part.
You know, in a weird way, he kind of was. Like, it... I bought him a lot more in the first half as, like, the gruff Daddy Warbucks, or Oliver Warbucks, I should say, when he's not Daddy yet. He's not Daddy yet. I bought him more as Oliver Warbucks in the first half when he has no idea what to do with this child and just is so kind of straight-laced businessman gruff. I bought him less when he had to sort of start having his heart melt and connect with her. I got absolutely no chemistry with him and Eileen Quinn. He was the same man from beginning to end, and maybe there was meant to be some sort of comedic, I don't say relief because it's supposed to be a comedic movie, it's a dark movie, but they're trying to make it comedic. I guess there's supposed to be some comedy there of him treating her like he would treat a business associate, and she's this little 10-year-old girl. But I don't know, it was just weird. It was a very weird performance.
Well, it would be interesting. I don't know if he has any kind of autobiography or whatever, but there are a lot of actors who don't like to play against children.
Yeah. He didn't have to do the movie, though.
But you never know.
No.
Paycheck.
Yeah. I'm sure it was a big paycheck. It was a very expensive movie to make. But, I don't know, he also has weird career choices. He did Murder on the Orient Express with the huge mustache as Poirot. You wouldn't know it now, but he used to be kind of a bit of a snack back in the 60s. Tom Jones, Two for the Road, he was a handsome man. Very cute in like a both boyish and gruff British way.
So what you're saying is he basically overplayed the gruff, harsh, cold-hearted Warbucks throughout. Like the melt wasn't there enough.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. When I say that I liked him, rather I bought him in the first half, it's not necessarily to say that I think that his performance was good in the first half. He still was doing very weird things, like making big, bold Johnny Depp-style choices. But it was at least like in... I was like, okay, I can sort of see what they're going for. I just don't think it succeeds.
I am now conducting a coast-to-coast nationwide search for Annie's parents. Drop page. Warbucks continues.
The person who I think succeeds the most in the movie is Anne Reinking as Grace. And she's not even really right for the role necessarily. She's a little too... She's not the right voice type, first of all, because Grace is a soprano, as we will later learn. And Anne Reinking was infamously not a soprano. But she had a great deal of warmth to her and really dropped in earnestness. She did a great job in All That Jazz. She does a great job here. She dances like a mother. And yeah. So, I mean, she has that one big number, We Got Annie, where they still kind of have her dance in a sexual way. Mm. To the point where it's like weird that a little girl's... The idea of adopting a little girl has gotten her so excited that she's dancing like she's in a Fosse show. You know? these are the things you got to think about as a choreographer. This woman is excited at the prospect of having an orphan in her home forever. So maybe don't have her dance with her pelvis. Just saying.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
Yeah, there was a lot of that the entire time. Though she looks great in that yellow dress. They also... The stage show, I don't think, really has much of a romance between Oliver Warbucks and Grace. I think it's more sort of implied towards the end, but it's not overt. This version gets them hooking up, right? And it's the classic, her hair is up the entire time, and then she starts letting it down. And he's like, Grace, I really like your hair that way.
It was interesting. The one thing that he did well, I think, was have that eureka moment that this is an attractive woman, and I spend so much time with her, and I'm really quite fond of her.
Yeah.
I think you can register that he registered that.
Sure. The scene with them on the patio after they go to the movies, and she's in the yellow dress right before We Got Annie, which is not in the stage show. It was added for the movie. It is a nice scene between them. But I always cringe at the... Now she's let her hair down, and I see her as a sexual object now. She's a woman. Whoa. But, you know, it was 1982. 16 Candles was just around the corner, and that has date rape. So, like, it's not as if we were in a great place with how to portray women on screen. So, they get a lot of passes just on, like, where cinema was at. And many good Gatsby, Bing is a king by far.
But Annie.
You know what they don't get a pass with, though?
What?
Two super racist characters.
Yes, terrible.
Punjab and the Asp.
It was appropriation, but not whatever.
No, it's not appropriation because they're not taking the culture and having white characters soak it up. Like, it'd be one thing if Anne Rankin came out with a turban and she was like, I just love the way it makes my hair feel. Like, started doing moves reminiscent of India or, like, Bollywood. That would be, like, cultural appropriation. This is just flat-out racist. You know? Do you know what I mean?
I do. I just, you know, the Jeffrey Holder part, Punjab, was ridiculous.
Very ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
And again, Punjab and the Asp are characters that are in the comic strip, and they're racist there too.
Wow.
I mean, first of all, again, the comic strip does its darndest to sort of fight racism during its era. You know, Annie sort of, for a comic strip that's supposed to be anti-union, Annie sort of starts a lot of unions. Mm-hmm. And it's, but their idea of being anti-racist is like, a black kid wants to join her union, and she's like, sure you can, you're an American, aren't you? You can help us shove coal, and she's like, you helped us find the best coal mine, Brandon, whatever his name is, you get to be manager. And he's like, wow, golly gee, manager. It's just, and the dialect they give a lot of the black characters in that comic of Annie is like very Song of the South, very Butterfly McQueen.
Yeah, oof.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like, you know, I understand, like, time period, and that's all relative, but also, like, you could have done a little bit better. And on top of that, Punjab and the Asp, who are supposed to be Oliver Warbucks's, like, bodyguards, Punjab, who's from India, the Asp, who is from supposedly China, they never really specify in the comic or the movie. And the Asp, from what I remember in the movie, doesn't speak at all. He just does a lot of karate. And, in We Got Annie, he and Punjab have their own little, like, dance solo towards the end. And they have Jeffrey Holder as Punjab doing, like, some weird mystical arm movements. And they turn the music into a Bollywood-style sound. Then the Asp goes, and they literally play, like, the chopstick kind of sound, like do 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 do, and he's doing like weird head rolls and karate moves, and it just happens, and you go, oh my god, they thought that this was cute. It just, those characters aren't in the stage show because Martin Charnin, listen, I'm not going to praise him this entire episode because I have some issues with him as a creative. One of the smartest things he and Thomas Meehan did were cut those characters from the stage show because they are racist as fuck. Just a couple of last notes I want to make on 1982 before we move along. They cut Tomorrow, or rather say they moved Tomorrow. So now it opens the movie over the opening credits. This is apparently because John Huston, the director, and Ray Stark, the producer, thought the song was really corny. So they moved it to the opening credits because they just couldn't bring themselves to put it in an actual scene. And then Annie sings it with the president at some point. They added a bunch of songs that do nothing. Dumb Dog, Stupid, Sign, which is where Oliver Warbucks comes over to get Miss Hannigan to sign the adoption papers, and she tries to seduce him and then ends up in the bathtub with her gin, and she's in her underwear the entire time. It's a stupid song. Nothing's accomplished. Apparently, it was written on the spot because Carol Burnett and Albert Finney said, we want a song together. So Martin Charnin and Charles Strauss were like, here. And they were like, great. They're like, it's our first draft. And they went, fantastic. Yeah. And that's the last couple things I wanted to say. And then just the kidnapping plot with Rooster and Annie, they get away with it for a minute, and Annie almost dies, and the orphans tell Warbucks that Annie was kidnapped. She's on a bridge, almost dead. Punjab unravels his turban to turn into a rope, which is, again, woof. That is also sort of in theme with
hanging from an autocopter.
Yes.
Which you've never seen before.
It's the grandiosity that this movie presents is astounding in a way that's like, oh, and then the movie ends with them singing I Don't Need Anything But You in a big fireworks display, because the movie takes place during the summer over July 4th, whereas the stage show and the 99 movie, it's during Christmas, which is a better time for the story to take place.
Together at last, together forever, we're tying a knot.
Yeah, the 1982 movie, it was the 10th highest grossing film of the year, grossing $57 million, which is just under $200 million today domestic, like $180 million. But it lost money because it cost so much money to make. Yeah, which leads us to the 1999 TV ABC Disney film version of Annie. I don't think you've ever watched this version before.
Oh, I can't remember.
I watched it a bunch because when it came on, it was a huge deal. It was part of the Wonderful World of Disney TV anthology that ABC started doing in 1997. They famously started it with Cinderella with Brandy and Whitney Houston. And then it was sort of, I think it was like once a month or every 2 months, maybe on a Sunday night, they would air an original movie of some sort. But Annie, I remember coming out, and that was really a big deal. And I got the VHS for it because I also got the VHS for Cinderella, and I watched those both a lot. And then I got the soundtrack for Annie because there's still famously no soundtrack available for Cinderella. And I listened to that a lot. But I don't think I ever made anyone in the house watch it with me. Maybe like a babysitter or two, but I don't think I ever watched it with you. Definitely never watched it with Dad. Definitely never watched it with Laura. My sister Laura. No. She and I would watch Clueless together. Sometimes Muppet Treasure Island, but mostly teen movies, never Annie. So I think this was probably your first viewing of it.
Could have been.
How did you feel about it?
I actually liked it better than the earlier version. First of all, I thought, what's the girl's name again?
Alicia Morton.
Alicia Morton had stage pipes.
Yes.
She had stage pipes, whereas the other was a smaller, thinner voice that couldn't really handle the range, I guess. But this girl was very good and knew how to project. She felt more natural in the role. And, you know, some of the casting was interesting. They didn't have Punjab in this one, did they?
No, they, because it's true to the stage show, which right. cut him and the asp. Yeah. Again, very wisely.
Gratuitous, and unless they needed someone tall to hang from the helicopter, you know.
Well, they cut that whole helicopter bit. Yeah, the 99 version, there is no Punjab, there is no the asp. There is no bridge that she dangles from. And yes, Alicia Morton, which is a name I will never forget. It'll stay in my brain forever because she was very important to me for a solid year. And her vocals are great.
Betcha he reads, betcha she sews. Maybe she's made me a closet of clothes. Maybe they're strict, as straight as a line. Don't really care as long as they're mine.
Eileen Quinn as Annie in the 1982 one, she is sort of shortchanged a bit because with Anne Reinking not being a soprano, a lot of the songs she sings with Eileen Quinn, the keys have to be altered for her range, which means Eileen Quinn thus has to sing in a lower register. And in the 99 version, we have Audra McDonald, the greatest soprano of all time, or rather to say the greatest living soprano. So we have the original keys, which means Alicia Morton gets to sing in her big, brassy, belty Broadway glory, and even goes up a couple of times where Andrea McArdle did not. There's a time where she hits an F, and I'm like, ooh, this girl could be a Vita. It's great. And they keep Tomorrow. Tomorrow still happens in the scene. And did you think it was too schmaltzy in the
no,
movie?
No, I thought, you know, you're in the Depression. It's a nice pepper-upper, right? It's,
yeah.
Optimistic, which with all the negative stuff that everybody's going through, is you know, in counterpoint.
Yeah, it's a nice remedy. The movie's very smart. The 99 movie's very smart because they do sort of frame it in a very sad way that, you know, she's outside, it's snowing, she just stole an ear of corn to eat, and she doesn't even get to eat it, and she's sort of sitting in an alleyway with this dog, and it starts off very light, so it doesn't feel like a gung-ho, gee-whiz kind of song. It feels very earned. I like it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very sweet, Alicia Morton. She's not quite as tough as Annie, as I gather Andrew McArdle probably was, and even Eileen Quinn in the 82 one, for reference. She starts off very tough, you know, she's always threatening to beat up the other orphans for yelling at Molly, and she runs from the police, she runs from the popo. But when she gets to the Warbucks mansion, she is very much like an earnest little sweet kid. But what I also like is that the musical and the 99 version, they don't frame her as like this once-in-a-lifetime ray of sunshine, like inspires everyone kind of a person. She just connects with all of her Warbucks. Like, they just have a connection. Whereas the 82 movie, it's like, this kid is so sensational, everyone's in love with her, and she doesn't do anything.
Well, you know, maybe it was consistent with the Bert Healy show. You know, that was so retro, and that one felt maybe a little bit more retro. I mean, the way Annie looked and mm-hmm. stuff, and that this one definitely felt, in some subliminal way, a little bit more modern.
Yeah, they had a little bit of a modern touch to it. Part of that, you sort of could see that with the casting as well. The racial diversity in this Annie, while maybe not the most of all time, was still probably the most, probably not the most racially diverse Annie now, was definitely the most racially diverse at the time. Annie famously has had issues with race. The original stage production did not cast any people of color, as far as I'm aware. They wanted to keep it historically accurate, and orphanages in the 30s were segregated, so there were no orphans of color, and I think that was sort of to their detriment at the time. And then the 82 version, you know, we have two characters for representation, and they are not the best representation. And then the 90s revival with Nell Carter, there was a little bit, you have Nell Carter, and I think a couple of the orphans were not white, but I was looking up on it, there was some controversy with that one as well, because they were running a TV ad for that revival, and they were using stock footage from the original production, and that Hannigan was white. They had like Marsha Lewis, who was a white actress, in the stock footage for the commercial, and Nell Carter's like, you're using my name, you're selling my name for tickets, but you're not showing my face in the commercials. That is, like, that is racist. And like, no, it's just the footage we had. She's like, shoot new footage, use me, you're selling my name, you're not showing me. Which she has a point.
I just want to go back to something because it took me all this time to remember the name of the show. So Annie on stage was intentionally not multi-ethnically cast.
Yes.
Blah, blah. But Martin made up for it because he created the first. And it took me a long time to remember that name.
What's
that
the first?
That was about Jackie Robinson.
Oh, right. Right. I mean,
it wasn't significant. I was making a joke.
Sure.
But
because, I mean, the first, for all the people that are in it that are real, it's amazing to think about because that show just doesn't exist.
No need to pick up any toys.
The kids will never believe this.
No finger will you lift, my dear.
We have but one request. Please put us to the test.
I know I'm gonna like it here.
Both versions of Annie have great casts. I would argue the 99 one has a cast that's better suited for their roles and follow through a bit better. Kathy Bates doesn't really play a kooky Hannigan, which I wish she did. I like the Hannigan she plays. She's not a drunk because this was televised on primetime and it was Disney, so they weren't going to have a drunk villain. And she wasn't overly sexual. She was more sort of a tough matriarch.
She was actually sadder than she was mean.
Yeah. She played her much more like a human being. And...
Well, Carol Burnett is caricature. I mean, that's,
sure.
That's what she does.
I mean, I would say Kathy Bates is Hannigan. Like, again, she sort of got evil towards the end. But for the first hour, you're like, this woman's not very evil. You know, she, like, yes, she's not great with the orphans. She's constantly making them clean and whatnot. But she's never violent with them.
She's not terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yeah.
She's more of a hard ass. Let's put it that way. And she turns evil at the end.
I don't think she was as much evil as she was corrupted.
Maybe. So, like, something in Annie that they've cut out since then, and they even make a reference to it in the 99 one, is that Hannigan does hit the kids.
Oh.
Or at least that's what it's supposed to be. The first time we hear, "I love you, Miss Hannigan," is when Annie first tries to escape the first time. She fails the first time, she succeeds the second, and the first time she... tries and fails, Hannigan catches her, has her bend over, has a paddle, like a big flat paddle, and smacks her on the butt with it a couple of times, and then she says, "What do you say?" And then Annie says through gritted teeth, "I love you, Miss Hannigan." Sort of like a very, like, "Please, thank you, sir, may I have another," kind of thing. And it's funny in a twisted way, because in Hannigan's eyes, by doing this, it's sort of making them understand, like, this punishment's for your own good. Don't you understand, by being a child, by definition, you are disgusting, and it's my job to make you not disgusting? And I think that's sort of what made Dorothy Loudon such a great heel in the role, was she was so earnest in her conviction that, like, these children are monsters, and they're out to get me, so of course I drink, wouldn't you? And, like, of course I make them clean. If I don't make them clean, they're gonna get me.
But, you know, we also commented that alcohol didn't show its face for a really long time in the 1999 version.
Not until this
right.
Later half, yeah.
Whereas it was omnipresent in the first one.
Yes, well, I think that has to do with the fact that it was a Disney-produced TV movie. Yes.
Comparison.
Yes, and when alcohol does show up on screen, it's, you know, a celebratory shot. Although, Easy Street, they do end it in a pub, which I think is fun.
I thought someone else had a bottle, like... Not Hannigan or Rooster, somebody had a bottle?
No. Warbucks mentions alcohol because when Annie shows up and they sing... Oh, first I want to say, the musical arrangements in the 99 version, they slap. They are so good. They are the best arrangements of that score ever, that ever will exist. It's just so good. And,
you know what? She also fills up the space in the house. Do you know what I mean? She's
yeah.
got the voice that fills up the space.
She does. And the... Warbucks Mansion in the TV movie, even though it's just basically one set and it's clearly not as big as the mansion in the 82 one, it looks more luxurious and more expensive, even though the TV movie obviously had like a fifth of the budget.
It also didn't feel completely lifeless, where
it was colorful.
It
yeah
was. the other. And remember, I said last night that I thought that the second version had a slightly more cartoony feel, excepting Carol Burnett, who I think was, you know.
Well, the 99 version, I think it was the colors. The colors were brighter and bolder, which, and because there was sort of a fakeness to the whole set, you knew it wasn't a New York City street. You
could tell it was a back lot.
No, what I'm saying is that, so I've often said, movie musicals in general are really difficult to pull off, especially now because we have entered this realm of like realism. Everything needs to look real, and musicals can't exist in that world. Every time people have tried, it fails miserably. You need a sort of slightly heightened sense of reality to make it work, because in musicals, everything has to be heightened enough that the singing makes sense. The emotions, everything. The stakes. And so by having this version of Annie take place in a slightly unrealistic world, where it's like, it's everything's realistic enough that you buy what they're feeling is real, but you can tell that the street she's on is not actually a New York City street. You can tell it's a movie studio lot, and that's not a bad thing, because
it's a good thing.
Yeah, because it gives it that slightly heightened sense of reality. It's a heightened version of New York in the 1930s.
And it also grounds you to the comic strip a little bit. When you're trying to be too on location-y, mm-hmm. it kind of loses some of the, it loses something when you're outside of New York City where it's done.
You look at La La Land, which is perhaps the most romantically photographed version of LA that you'll ever see, because LA is notoriously not a pretty town. And it works because it's an LA that doesn't really exist.
Right.
And so the musical numbers work. They feel both real and earned in the world that the movie has set for itself. And that's what this version of Annie does, I think, agree. Very well.
I agree.
But when she shows up at the house, this is all coming back to the booze thing. When she shows up at the house and they do, I think I'm going to like it here, which slaps so hard. And then Warbuck shows up, played by Victor Garber. And ooh boy. Could Victor Garber be called daddy?
I'd push you out of the way, but I understand he's not interested.
Well, I know he's got a man in his life, so that's fine. But, Victor
beautiful
Garber.
Beautiful voice, too. Really beautiful.
Yeah. He's a Broadway dude. He was in the original Sweeney Todd. He sang Joanna, and he was in the Godspell movie as Jesus. He used to have a big head of hair, which of course they shaved for this. But he's also very sexy in the Cinderella movie. He's sexy in Legally Blonde. He's just sexy. He's Victor Garber. He shows up and he, like all versions of Annie, he shows up when Annie shows up and he doesn't know what to do with her because he's not a kid guy. It's clearly a promotional stunt to have this orphan stay the week with him, which, by the way, is a very cruel stunt.
It is. It's terrible.
Take this kid who's known nothing but cold mush and scrubbing floors, give her the lap of luxury for a week, and then send her back on her way, which I don't know if the show is ever aware that that's kind of a gross thing to do, but I don't think so.
I think it was a fantasy. You know, maybe that's what the original, the comic book at least was.
It's something that I could imagine actually happening in 1933. I could imagine a billionaire for promotional purposes like inviting an orphan into his home and then sending her back. I could imagine that happening.
Maybe Albert Finney was too old for that role. It was hard for them to connect.
He was just living in a different movie as far as I'm aware. Was. Everyone was in a different movie. Everyone in the 99 one is in the same movie, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But he says, you know, for trying to think of something to do, he says to Annie, I'll bring you to my club for cigars and scotch. And that alone is ridiculous. And I love it. And then I love Arthur McDonald's responses. Your club's men only, sir. And I'm like, that's because that was the problem in the plan. That was the problem.
Not the cigarettes and the booze. Cigars and the booze.
And so then his response is, okay, then we'll have brandy.
Yeah.
It's like, those are the kind of jokes that I think are in the
that's
stage
like
show, too.
Right out of my big fat Greek wedding.
Yeah. It's the...
She doesn't eat.
Ian doesn't eat meat. He's a vegetarian. That's okay. I make lamb. He don't eat no meat. My Big Fat Greek Wedding. We should watch that sometime.
I know.
That movie's good. Easy Street. something they do in the 99 version that I love, and they didn't do it in the 82 version, I don't know why. There is a song in Annie. It's called NYC. It's about what? New York City. Basically, like, the thing that makes Warbucks first fall for Annie, it's like the seed that's planted, is he takes her out to see the city, to go to the movies. In the 82 version, they're like, great, we're just going to go straight to the movies. They're going to get into his car, and they're going to go to Radio City Music Hall, which, by the way, they go see Camille, because the thing you want to take a 10-year-old to see is Camille, where Greta Garbo plays a courtesan who dies of consumption. Take the kid! Fun for the whole family! Also, after we watched it, I told you this, I want to tell our listeners, Annie takes place in 1933. Camille didn't come out till 1936. Booyah. Also in the song Let's Go to the Movies, they make a reference to Shirley Temple. Shirley Temple didn't become a movie star till 1934. Booyah. 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 You've just been pwned. But the whole point is that of the song isn't so much that she's going to a movie. It's that Annie has lived in New York City her whole life and she's never seen the city because she's been cooped up all the time. And every time she escapes, it's to try to find her parents. So she's not even looking around the sights. She's looking for her parents. So the 82 one doesn't understand that. They're like, oh, well, the appeal is going to see a movie. The 99 version is like, the appeal is seeing the city. And by having her see the city, Warbucks sees the city through her eyes and falls in love with her. By seeing the wonder as she experiences all anew.
What you saw was she was holding his hand, mm-hmm. which she might have initiated, but when he had to pick her up when she was sleeping mm-hmm. and take her home, that to me was the moment.
Oh, you cried.
Oh, stop.
let's call it what it is. You cried.
Maybe.
You cried a little bit at the end of the 82 one when she was being kidnapped and they were singing the Maybe reprise, but that's like, you know.
Wait a minute. I nipped it in the bud because I could feel it
You could
coming.
Feel it coming on. You cried
a couple. In the back of my nose, my eyes, you know?
But you cried a couple of times in the 99 one. The first one was when they come home from their night out and she's asleep in the car and he picks her up.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of times when they're going around the town. She's grabbing his hand all throughout New York City during NYC, but it's not a kind of, I want you to fall in love with me kind of way. She wants to see things and he's moving too slowly. So she grabs his hand. She's like, come on. And when they're outside of a toy store and she can't see through the window, he picks her up and puts her on his shoulder. It's sweet things. But then there are also humorous things like they go get their shoes shined and Annie decides to shine the shoes of the shoe shine boy. They get in a snowball fight and Warbucks misses and hits somebody and so they have to run. It's like it's a night out and it's cute. And on top of all of that.
Very familial.
Very familial. And on top of all of that, we have the cameo of all cameos.
Oh, yes.
When they go see a Broadway show and who plays the star to be but Andrea fucking McArdle.
Yes.
Singing up a storm.
She did.
You didn't realize it was Andrea for a second.
It took me a minute. I mean, I knew she was in it because I had seen the credits, mm-hmm. but I really wasn't paying attention. Then all of a sudden, it's like, boom.
You were wrapped up in the story.
Oh, I guess so.
You were wrapped up in the emotions.
I liked the singing, actually, so I was listening to that.
Well, the arrangements are amazing. Victor Garber and Audra McDonald harmonizing? Yes, please. Yes, God. And then Alicia Morton joins them at the end for three-part harmony, and yes. Alicia Morton takes the alto line, and it's great.
Yeah, it was wild.
It's fantastic. The arrangements of this movie slap. It's so good.
It was good.
Because I remembered loving the 99 one, but after we watched the 82 one, I was like, is the 99 one going to hold up? Because I listened to the 99 one a lot, and the arrangements always hold up. But I'm like, I don't want this movie to not be as good as I remembered it. And it was actually kind of better. It's definitely sweeter than the stage show. They take out all sense of politics in the 99 one. The stage show has politics sort of looming around and makes jokes about it. You know, oh, what did Democrats eat? And, you know, the 82 one politics is mostly out. Annie still visits the president. And then there's also a Bolshevik who tries to bomb Warbucks' mansion. And it's handled so cavalierly.
Yeah.
But it's a reference to the fact that Warbucks made his money, according to the comic books, Warbucks made his money selling weapons during World War I, which is obviously like where the name comes from, War Bucks. Mm-hmm. He made his bucks from the war. Mm-hmm. But the movie, the 82 movie, like, it's so, they have Anne Rankin say the line like, the Bolsheviks don't want anyone to know that capitalism works, and Warbucks is living proof that it does. And I'm like, you're in the middle of the Great Depression. Clearly it doesn't work. This keeps happening.
Yeah, right?
We have the Depression. We've had two recessions since the 21st century started. Like, clearly capitalism is flawed. And maybe the Bolsheviks are onto something. I don't know. We've been watching The Americans, and I've been getting corrupted by Carrie Russell.
What you wear from ear to ear, and not from head to toe.
That matters.
Ah, the lovely Boiling Sisters.
So sad. Also, like, the choreography in the 99 one, it's a little more, the whole thing is a little more theatrical, but the choreography, like, I don't know. It's maybe less, like, over the top, but it just is cleaner.
It's cleaner and less gaudy.
Yeah, the 82 one, everything is just on crack. Everyone is tumbling. Everyone is breaking bones.
It was like
bones.
Be Our Guest, right? It's a little bit like Be Our Guest.
Kind of, but, like, even Be Our Guest knows when to say when.
I guess, yeah.
Or at least I should say the 91 Be Our Guest knew when to say when. The Emma Watson remake did not, which Audra is in, by the way. And those assholes get Audra McDonald in their movie, and they have her sing for about 35 seconds at the beginning and 35 seconds at the end, and I say that is a hate crime, that is homophobic. If they really, and they were like talking about how this new Beauty and the Beast was gay friendly, I'm like, you want it to be gay friendly? You have Audra McDonald push Emma Thompson off the goddamn screen to say, this is my moment, bitch, and have Audra sing Beauty and the Beast. That is gay rights, honey.
But we digress.
Do we, though? Because Audra's in Annie as well. Okay. So it's a natural transition.
Good theme. Good yes. Thread.
Andrew McArdle is the star to be. My final thoughts on her.
I thought she was very good. I was fascinated by her. And I was like, this is sort of random, you know. And then all of a sudden the light bulb went off and say, oh, here, this is her cameo. This is her special appearance.
Well, it's interesting that Solo has become a very famous Solo. I don't know if it was that famous at the time, so it's actually really smart of them to have included it. But since then, the star to be in NYC has been something, because the original star to be in the Broadway production was Laurie Beachman, who went on to become the narrator in Joseph, which Papa San's wife Fran famously cast.
It's too confusing for me.
Well, the bottom line is that our family has fingers in all of theatrical history. That's what we're saying here,
okay,
honey.
Okay, fine.
And then when they did the revival in the 90s, Sutton Foster played the star to be, and then Andrew McArdle did the TV movie. So, like, that Solo sort of become like a coveted Solo.
Nice.
Because you could become Laurie Beachman, you could become Sutton Foster, Andrew McArdle. But yeah, she sounds great. Kristen Chenoweth in a small role. She just come off a Tony win. Kristen Chenoweth, Alan Cumming, and Kathy Bates doing Easy Street is the only thing that can rival Carol Burnett, Tim Curry, and Bernadette Peters doing Easy Street.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. Why did they switch out Lily St. Regis and Miss Hannigan in the effort to adopt Annie?
Oh, in the con where they had Hannigan play?
Yeah, but they didn't in the other.
Yeah, so it's never been Hannigan before. That's the only change that kind of confused me. I don't necessarily know why they did it. Maybe it was to give Hannigan more screen time. Mm-hmm. Because in the show, she's complicit, but she doesn't pose as the mom, and she gets arrested. In the 82 movie, she's still complicit, but then has a change of heart all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's weird, too.
Very weird and unearned.
Yeah.
Because basically what it is like, they're on their way. She knows they're going to kill her. And then when Annie escapes and Rooster says, I'm going to kill you, she's like, wow, he's really going to kill her. I got to stop this. I was like, what did you think was going to happen before all of this? Where Hannigan turns super evil in the 99 one is, A, she replaces Lily in the con, but also when it's made clear that Annie's going to get killed, she has no qualms with it. She's like, yeah, okay, whatever. Anything to get my 25 grand. Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe, I guess, to give Kathy Bates more screen time towards the end. The whole con in the TV movie, it's mostly fine. It's really the Hannigan switch is the only thing that I don't get, but it offers us a great scene with Kristen Chenoweth and all the orphans playing poker, which I think is very funny.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the turn that she... They already sort of show that she's going to be the loose lips that sink the ship, because when they first try to beat Annie's parents for Hannigan to con her, Kristen Chenoweth slips up. She goes, she was our perfect little boy. I mean, girl.
Yes.
It's just so hard to tell when they don't have hair. It's so funny. And then
look to Rooster for yes, that's right.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's
no
like, right?
Other way to tell.
It's like, yes, and me here, Rooster. We are trying to do something. And then when the orphans get her to spill about the plan, and they go, well, what makes you think they're going to come back for you? She goes, because I'm Rooster's girl. I memorized the line. He never leave me to take the fall and spend 3 months on Rika's Island. Again. It's so funny. And it tells you all you need to know because, yes, it justifies her ratting them out because it's happened before, but it also shows how stupid she is because it's happened before. Why did she think today was going to be different? It took this moment.
Yeah.
And then because, like, it's almost the end of the con, she's got to go finish it off. They give Audra Moore to sing. They have her sing a nice reprise of Maybe and Tomorrow, which I'm all for. Victor Garber sings some songs. They put back some songs from the show that the original movie cut, but they cut some other stuff that the original movie cut as well. They still cut We Like to Thank You, Herbert Hoover, which is when Annie, like, visits a Hooverville, which I understand. It's the only overly political song in the show and is probably the smartest lyrics Martin Charnin wrote for the show. But they're characters we never really see again, and the show kind of does away with the poor once Annie gets brought into the Warbucks mansion. Like, her thoughts on what it is to be poor don't really... They kind of go out the window.
Let's just say she adapts really easily.
Yes. She adapts to her surroundings very easily. Which, granted...
I'm going to like it here.
Yeah, you're an 11-year-old. It's like, yeah, I too would be like, yeah, screw my previous life. I love this. Final overall thoughts on the 99 one?
No, I liked it much more. I think it was actually accessible to grown-ups as well.
Yeah.
It's very watchable. It's enjoyable. There's great talent on there. I mean, there's talent in the other two, but just felt, you know, at once bigger and smaller.
Yeah. Well, it's less dark and less weird and less sexual.
Yeah.
But it's a better overall product, which is why I feel like adults will like it more. Because you won't feel like your intelligence is being compromised or that you have no clue what you're seeing.
Right.
Everything makes sense.
Right. What is a question?
Yes.
Sort of random. Whatever happened to Annie's braids? We never did get...
You're referring to 82 Annie. Yes. With her, like, jerry curl.
Pigtail things sticking out of her big fro.
Like a jerry curl almost. Yeah,
no, it looked like it had rubber bands on her.
Maybe. Yeah, she's got her big poofy hair at the beginning of the movie, and then these two little, like, it looks like she's got rat tails.
Yeah.
She's got her big poofy hair and these two little rat tails on the bottom, and then it goes away. I don't know what that's about.
Continuity, maybe.
Maybe? I truly don't know. I cannot tell you what any of those decisions were in that 82 movie. I couldn't tell you a goddamn one. There was another remake in 2014 with Quvenzhané Wallace as Annie and Jamie Foxx as Warbucks, although his name was Mr. Stax, and Cameron Diaz as Miss Hannigan. And I watched this movie a couple of years ago. This movie was very controversial because all the racists came out and said, why is there a black Annie? And I say, deal with it. But here's the thing. It's a terrible movie. And we didn't watch it, Mama, because I was reacquainting myself with it to see if we should watch it.
Mm.
It's so, so, so not the show to the point that I was like, there's no need to watch it. There's no reference to it. It's not an adaptation. They basically just took the basic concept of Annie, took some of the songs, sort of, and then went along with it. But even then, so like, they wrote a couple of new songs, or rather I should say, Martin and Charles did not write new songs. Sia wrote some new songs, Jay-Z, I think Jay-Z. And then they took a couple of the original songs. They took Tomorrow and Maybe, which are still mostly the same, although they get a little sort of hip-hop remix. Then they took Little Girls and I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here and Easy Street, and they basically just took the title of the song and like two lines from it and then rewrote everything else. So like, I Think I'm Gonna Like It Here, she's like, I think I'm gonna like it here. Yes, yes. And this is the whole new song, Little Girls. Basically, Cameron Diaz is like, little girls, everywhere I turn, I can see them. New verse of something totally different. And I'm like, this is not the song. Plus, this movie's weirdly aware that it's a musical. So every time people break out into the song, everyone's like, why are you singing? Cameron Diaz all the time was like, when they're singing Hard Knock Life, she's like, less singing, more cleaning. And when she's doing Little Girl, she's like, I'm not singing, I'm asking you, please kill me. And I'm like, what the? Stop it. It's so embarrassed to be a musical. It's so embarrassed to be Annie. Mm. The one thing they do that I think is very smart is that the movie opens and then they're in a classroom and this little redheaded girl is giving a speech about one of the presidents, and then she goes away, and then the teacher turns to Kwon Janae Wallace and goes, Annie B, you're up. And it's like, aha, that's the Annie you knew. This is the Annie of now. I like that passing of the torch. The whole movie is downhill from there. They also, again, they move it to present day, and or rather say to 2014, and it doesn't work because a lot of what makes Annie work is the specific time period it takes place in, 1933, not 2014. Mm. Yeah. No, it's just odd. It's odd. There's one other thing I'm going to say about the 2014 version I hate. I mean, essentially all of it. But they also give Hannigan the redemption, which makes no sense. Also, Jamie Foxx is running for mayor, so it's all a political ploy.
Who plays Rooster in that?
There is no Rooster. Bobby Cannavale plays Jamie Foxx's campaign manager, and he's, like, the evil person. But what it's supposed to be is, like, Miss Hannigan's evil, then we meet Bobby Cannavale, and he's evil, and they team up to do the whole, like, kidnapping plot with Annie and, like, finding someone to be her fake parents. Then Hannigan gets cold feet, tells Jamie Foxx, and then they're like, Bobby Cannavale, you're fired. And everything's okay in the end. And it's not...
Why? Why did they torture the story that way?
I don't know. I think it's one of those things where I think a studio went, we have the rights, we have the property, let's remake it. It's a guaranteed box office thing because people know it. Let's get stars who people like. We're going to update it so it's a Black Annie, which is great. And Kwon Janae Wallace actually has a decent singing voice. Unfortunately, they auto-tune her to high heaven. And as we saw in Beast of the Southern Wild, girlfriend can act. But they just, everything, the idea of the project, I'm not against. It's how they did the project. And it ruins that opportunity. So I'm mad at them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we have to say about the 2014 one. Looking through my notes. No more. I will say, they don't have Punjab and the Asp in the 2014 one, so congrats to them.
Yes, there's been progress.
There's been some progress. The TV version premiered to 27 million viewers and was nominated for 12 Emmys, winning two. The 82 version was nominated for 2 Oscars. It won neither. It was nominated for, I believe, 5 Razzie Awards, which are the Oscars for bad movies. They won one, which was Worst Supporting Actress for Eileen Quinn, which I think is a little cruel. I don't like awarding children Razzies. I think that's rude. They're only as good as the directors they have, mm-hmm. in my opinion. And yes, I don't love Eileen Quinn in the movie, but I think giving her a Razzie is really awful.
Mm.
But again, shows you where we were in 1982. Final thoughts on Annie, Mother?
Well, I'm glad to have had the trip down memory lane. It was kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know, it was fun watching them with you. I watch movies differently when I watch them with you.
Aw.
Yeah. I mean, and it's sort of a nice thing to do. So, you know, I don't think it was a waste of time. I'm not sure that I would run to watch them again so soon, but I enjoyed them, and I definitely enjoyed the second one, the 1991 one, much more.
You would be more likely to watch the 99 one again than
yes.
the 82 one.
Yes, 99, I guess.
Yeah, the 99 one. And yeah, we won't be watching the 99 one again anytime soon, mostly because we've got 4 seasons of The Americans to get through.
Yes, we do.
But if, like, let's say in 2 months, I were to say, would you want to watch that Annie again? I feel like you would say yes.
Well, it's entertaining. I mean, you know, the you don't feel like, uh-oh, here comes a song.
Yeah.
It just sort of is well integrated.
It's also a tight 90 minutes.
It is.
And we watched both of those coming off of a lot of sort of dark stuff, because we have The Americans. We watched Promising Young Woman, which I did love, but it is twisted.
Mm-hmm.
Even Bridgerton, which is like a lot of fun fluff. There's, you know, some tricky sexual play going on.
Correct.
There. The only thing more horny than Bridgerton is the 1982 Annie.
It was ridiculous.
So horny. So horny, baby. Yeah.
Watch the rentals of that one go up because of what you just
said. Just because of what I said. Everyone's going to start renting the 82 Annie on Amazon now.
That's it.
Hornier than Bridgerton. I got to see this. I did find out one of the girls. So do you remember when we were watching the 82 Annie? When she comes back to the orphanage with Sandy and they're all singing like lines about what to name Sandy. And there's one girl who like belts, like she goes, Rover, why not think it over? Some blonde girl. And you're like, she could have been Annie.
Yeah.
She was in the finals for it.
She was
one of the final girls for Annie. I guess they thought she looked a little too old or something like that. And so they gave her a solo. And then that girl, Sally, that actress is deceased recently, but she went on to play the lead opposite Patrick Dempsey in Can't Buy Me Love.
No,
so she actually kind of got a big career boost post Annie instead of Eileen Quinn.
It was almost startling to hear this, you know, big voice.
Yeah.
Come like out when everybody else is sort
of,
you know.
Yeah, these whispery kids being like, Sandy or Banana, champion, you're anything but. And then she goes, Rover. And you're like, and you sit there, you go, that's a star.
Yeah.
And clearly Hollywood thought so because she starred in Can't Buy Me Love like 5 years later. So get it. What's her name? I have the name. I just want to say her name to give her credit. Hold on. I have it written down. Amanda Peterson. That is who it was. Also, apparently, Bette Midler was once offered Hannigan for the 82 one, and she turned it down.
Oh, she would have been good.
She would have been very good. I'm sad she didn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I guess in conclusion, anyone out there who scoffs at Annie, says it's treacly, that it's sweet and saccharine, it is a little bit, but it's also incredibly well made. And don't judge it based off of the 82 one. Don't even judge it based off of the 99 one, because the stage show has a lot more grit and intelligence to it than might let on. However, if you want a version that slaps, if you want arrangements that slap and great singing and just a tight 90 minutes of fun, get yourself Disney Plus and watch the 99 one. By the way, this episode is sponsored by Disney Plus.
You wish.
Yes, I do wish. I think today we will close out with Andrea McArdle, as we did not get a chance to close out with her before, and I would like to have everyone listen to her amazing Star to Be solo. Alright, so this has been Broadway Breakdown. Thanks for coming on, Mama.
You're welcome.
Let's maybe go have some dinner now.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Yeah, I am too. Let's go watch The Americans. And thank you for listening, guys. Remember to rate, subscribe, write a review, share with your friends if you like, and we will catch you next time. Take us away, Andrea. Bye!
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.